Hello, this is Deborah Anderson, the Black Woman Animator, coming back to you with another video. And in this video, I have Autumn Brion. Welcome, welcome, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Can you introduce yourself?
Yeah. My name is Autumn Brion. I am an artist. I'm based in Los Angeles, and my studio is in Inglewood.
Inglewood. So you're from South LA. How was it growing up?
Yeah. LA is home. LA is a fantastic place to grow up, and my childhood in LA is a big part of what influences my creative practice even now. Mm-hmm. I grew up with my mom and my grandparents, and I got to see very different parts of LA. And I also got to experience like a lot of creative parts of LA, like specifically like Black creative parts of LA.
Nice.
So I got to spend time like seeing Alvin Ailey every time they would come to Los Angeles. I grew up taking dance classes at the same place where my Girl Scout troop was on 105th and Central. Mm-hmm. I loved going to musicals and plays with my family. I think LA is such a cool place to grow up to like foster creativity.
Yeah. What are some of your best childhood memories?
Ooh. Probably seeing Alvin Ailey with my mom and my aunts every year. That's something I would always look forward to. And like, I would always get a poster from every performance that I went to. So eventually I had them all, like I curated them like in my room so that I could see all of them. Mm-hmm. But that's such a special memory. And like seeing Revelations at every show.
Yes.
Like hearing like the music that I heard on Sundays when I went to an AME church, like hearing those types of Negro spirituals and seeing modern dance with that, like blew me away the first time I saw it. And then I wanted to see it every year.
Right. That sounds wonderful. So a book, the book, A Wrinkle in Time was monumental in your childhood. What was it to see a Black female director, Ava DuVernay, bring the book to life on screen?
Yeah, that was incredible. That was incredible. I've always loved the book. That book inspired me to want to be a scientist. But I also think it helped me see like the creativity that is so innate within technology and science. You know, like I really think it helped me see that too. But seeing it come to life on the big screen, there being a Black girl lead, a Black director, that was a dream come true. I was so impressed.
Nice. I can only imagine for to have that book be so monumental and to be like, oh, it's gonna be Black
in my lifetime. Yeah, that was everything. But it also made me hungry for more of that, so that I wouldn't be so surprised, so that it didn't feel like such a novelty, you know what I mean?
Like I know when I saw Black Panther 2 and I mean, because I don't read the comic books or anything, so everything is a surprise. And so, like, when the when they went to the college to get the scientist, and it was a Black girl, I was like, all right.
Yeah.
Because I'm just like, you know, you just expect it to not be us.
I know. And it's a shame when we acknowledge, like, how socialized and conditioned we've been to not expect to see ourselves.
Yeah.
It's just so counterintuitive. Like, what? Like... Which is why I'm always like taking a step back when I am surprised or shocked to see Black leads, Black creators. Like I want that surprise and like the unexpected part of that to end. I think that we're past that. And I really think that like within our lifetimes, like, like the folks that are coming after us, they expect to see folks like us in the room as they should. So I think we're getting closer.
Yeah. Cause I remember, you know, back in the day, like McDonald's had the little 365 where they would just play Black, they do like little documentaries or something like that on Saturdays. And I remember like my first kind of foray into the surprise of like, I don't know, was it Black Excellence or something like that? But they were covering Hattie McDaniel and like and different other people. And when she like gave her acceptance speech and it was like, articulate, I'm like, why am I surprised? Because you know, it's acting what they had to play on character on screen, but you didn't think about how like just how we have to code switch in acting today, I didn't think about, oh, maybe she's articulate in real life. Like,
I know, because we had only seen her as the mammy archetype.
So it just was like kind of a like a shame of sort to be like surprised that she was articulate.
It also reinforces the importance of us seeing fully realized Black women frequently and all around us, the same way that we see that in real life. I think that that needs to be reflected in entertainment and art. Like, it's important.
So, what is your cultural makeup? That's not the only say, what's your ethnicity, but also what is the culture of where you grew up and the uniqueness of where you're from?
Ooh, I love that question. I think that growing up in Los Angeles and specifically having a childhood in South Central is a huge part of my culture. And also the Black women that I grew up with. I think that's a really big influence on how I see the world, how I show up in the world. I did this this performance piece and an AR sculpture of Biddy Mason and a
I saw
performance
that
honoring Biddy
on your
Mason. I was
Instagram.
so proud of it. I was so proud of it. The central question that I asked was me interviewing different people that live in Los Angeles and asking, how did you get here? Tell me the story of how you got to LA.
Yeah, I saw some of those too.
Isn't that so powerful? Like seeing all of these stories, like some of them like adventurous, sometimes it's something kind of whimsical, but all of the things that bring people to one location. And that's what's so rich about Los Angeles is all of the ways that people have come here, and especially like elders and ancestors that were part of the Great Migration to LA.
I'm familiar with like the LA to LA, like Louisiana to LA migration and stuff like that. Because I lived in New Orleans for 12 years before moving here. So it'll be interesting for that to be done in New Orleans because particularly when I first moved to New Orleans in 2008, there were a lot of people from New Orleans who were like, why'd you want to move here? And so they didn't even see the like wondrousness of what New Orleans was. It's like they grew up there. So just like, why do people want to come here? And so to do that project for people who came to New Orleans and then share it with people from New Orleans. I mean, they're not everybody from New Orleans thinks like that, but just for those people who are just like, why would you move to New Orleans? Like, well, let's play what why people did move to New Orleans, and then you can kind of see what other people think of where you grew up.
Oof, I would love to do that kind of piece in New Orleans. That's one of my favorite cities in the world. Yeah, that's a beautiful place. And also just like another place that's very rich in history and in culture. And there's like a heaviness, I think, with all of that richness. And it's not just the heaviness of like the humidity that you feel, but like you can feel history like at every corner in New Orleans. It's such a cool place to
Have
live.
you ever tried to go to Whitney Plantation?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I've been there like four times. Like, 'cause it's like one of the only plantations in the country that concentrate on the slaves. So I was just like, yes, let's do this again. 'Cause
Yeah.
then they also have like new pieces that they had, and I was kind of sad when I don't know if there was like a hurricane or something that happened a few years ago and a lot got destroyed, so that they're like, you know, bring it back or whatever. But yeah, I liked it.
Yeah.
So what was your journey in art during your childhood, considering you chose to go into STEM initially?
Yeah. So art showed up in my childhood, very much so through dance. I did ballet, I did modern dance, I was with a performing company. And I think that I always applied like a creative approach to my interest in engineering and then eventually my work and my research in engineering. I didn't know that I would end up an artist or that meant that I was an artist. I just thought that that was the way that like I saw the world. I didn't know that like there was a name for it and like that there were mediums that I could use for that expression. I started focusing on my creative practice seriously. While I was in South Africa, actually, I started going to some of the art fairs that were on the continent. And building relationships with galleries, with artists, with curators, and really understanding that ecosystem of art and contemporary art. And that was really my like my education, the learning that I got about contemporary art.
So you studied aeronautics and astronautics at Stanford University. What was the path that you were on? And then how did you change your path?
I was really interested in astrobiology, and specifically how particulates can survive very high in the atmosphere. And a lot of the work that I was doing around that research and within AeroAstros was with cube satellites. So these very small satellites that made research really affordable and easy at the time, because it was an easy way to research and put apps within a small payload. So I thought that I was going to continue down that path. I had worked at Northrop, worked at NASA, and that's what I was thinking of continuing to do. But I got more and more interested in social entrepreneurship and finding creative ways specifically to increase Black girls' interest in STEM. That was just something that was really exciting me. And at first, it was something that I would do when I wasn't working. I thought that it was like a nice to have and something that I could do separately, but I just felt so much more fulfillment. And that's when I started to lean into and really look for ways that I could like cultivate ecosystems that could create impact and change. That's when I really started focusing on that and figuring out how I could do that through my work. And when I found out that that could be a career, but it started by just seeing what brought me more excitement. And deciding to organize my life around it.
So what is your relationship with the analytical and the creative, and how do they interact with each other? Because, well, for me, myself personally, I was going to become an electrical engineer before I found animation. So I'm a creative, but I also have that analytical part. And I tell people that, you know, my analytical kind of keeps my creative in a prison sometimes.
Oh, really?
Yes. So what I feel like you probably have a different journey. So I want to hear about yours.
Well, I'm curious about that. Tell me.
Okay. So like, I feel like, you know, being creative, this is this free thing. Yeah. And sometimes the analytical kind of squashes it down, and that doesn't allow me to be as free. And then now I'm in a space where, you know, I am a 3D modeler, and I know how to traditionally 3D model, but now there's like this program ZBrush that is digital sculpting. And so the program, I can see how it's very much discovery and playing around, which is not my strong suit. Like the way I learn is like step by step.
Okay.
And so I've struggled for years learning this program, because also I'm a recovering perfectionist. So your sculpt is ugly until it's not. And so I have to like change my brain from like enjoying the journey of the art rather than the finished product. Because in like when I traditionally 3D model, my natural propensity is like to, like if I have like my that Batmobile that is very popular that people see, like if I create the frame, then I'm immediately going to some detail on it. And that is, but you know, sometimes normally you create the form or the shape and then you get all that solidified and then you go to the detail. But my brain kind of goes to details really quickly.
Interesting.
Yeah.
It sounds like you're applying an analytical way of thinking to how you want to change your approach, right?
Yes, that's the changing their approach is very analytical as well. So what is your personal experience with how you combine your analytical and creative, and like, how do they intermingle with each other in your life and process?
Yeah. A big part of my practice is research-based. And that's probably informed from my engineering background, informed by my engineering background. So every time there's a central question, I'm always interested in the historical context around that question, but then also finding out how real people feel about the same question that I'm asking. So for example, I'm working on this project right now. It's around office housework. And that's basically the tasks that folks are asked to do within the workplace outside of their job description.
Oh yeah, usually to women.
Exactly,
I've
exactly.
been in like a radical, like, I will not plan a party. I'm not like
Girl.
I've been in the position where I've had to take notes, but it actually has put me in rooms that I would not be in before. So it's like a catch 22 where it's like, I get to learn this information because they have me being the note taker, the secretary.
Exactly. That shouldn't be what it takes. You know, like I'm sure you benefited from like the creative way that you navigated through office housework, but you shouldn't be required to do so. So I read this Harvard Business Review article, and there was a study that was done on office housework. Non-white men are twice as likely to be asked to do office housework. And it's tasks like exactly what you said, taking notes, sending a Zoom link to everyone, finding a time that everyone can meet. So I was reading about this, but then I was just interested. So that was me creating the context and in understanding this issue. But now I'm asking folks to give me examples of the office housework that they've been asked to engage in. So I'm asking folks to, I created this phone number and I'm asking folks to send screenshots of when they've been asked to do office housework in a text message and an email. It's been a shame to see the kind of stuff that people are asked to do. But that kind of analysis, research, I do think that it's informed by my engineering background, but I just use it for my creative practice now. And then that kind of information that I gather is what I use for the performances that I do. So I'm going to be using the info that I gather from that for a performance that I'm doing at Ghirardelli Square during Fog Art Fair, actually.
Nice. I feel like a tangential element to that is like the idea of black men in the school system having to be the disciplinarian, or like black people at work, which I refuse to do, is like the DEI people. Like, you ain't paying me extra for this, so I ain't trying to figure out how to get more people. Like, you know, you do want more people, like where you will suggest jobs, but like giving me work to do, or I have to
More
lead,
labor.
like I have to lead this group for no extra pay.
And also, how is one person or one committee going to solve systemic racism in addition to being an animator, in addition to like the full workload that you already have? You know, it's counterintuitive to ask a black woman to do more labor to end the problems that have caused her to have to do more labor in the first place. Yeah, it's
Yes, it's
bad.
never them doing more work.
Ever. No,
Like,
no.
even in them doing the work, they ask us to do the research. Like, oh, what can I do? Like, Google.
Exactly.
I've told people that I'm not the 101 black person. Like, I'm not like there's the 101 black people who are gonna teach you like the basics. I'm the you have done the research and you're coming to me with a pointed like question so we can have a conversation. I'm not about to teach you the basics.
Exactly. I'm so happy to hear, and it's an interesting to hear about how you've been engaging in refusal, like what your boundaries are, and how clear you are about that, and accountable, and saying, this is what I will not do, this is what I will do. And I think that's so important. I
And
think that's so important to
it's not
model.
easy. Like, I've been in spaces where I choose to fall on the sword for other people because you know, sometimes in the animation industry, people are very, you know, socially anxious or shy or introverted or, you know, all the things. And that's where I come from, like, but I've grown since then, so I'm like, oh, I see somebody else being treated, well, I'll take the hit because I don't care. And they really do not like you. Like, some people are not used to people sticking up for themselves, and it's like, I don't care because my like I've done the not sticking up for myself. And then like as a at a previous position, like initially I was sticking up for myself, and then I kind of was over it and stopped, and then I started again. And then I had this like realization, like, oh wow, like obviously I am dealing with some racism and sexism, but how much of it could have been avoided if I stuck up for myself? Because like I remember like when I started sticking up for myself again, and my supervisor would be like, oh, okay. And I'm like, what? Like, oh, that makes sense. Oh. So the past 2 years when I gave up, like it's not like a shooing away of like what we deal with, but some of it is like we can fight back. So.
Did you find that, or do you find that it's easier for you to fight back the more that you do it?
Yeah. But it's like because I come from the north, and I'm like, particularly when I was in the south, I'm a direct person, and I'm not rude. I'm just direct, and sometimes direct is rude. And so trying to strategically figure out how to phrase things, because I personally feel like sometimes no matter how I phrase things, people are offended. And sometimes I sit there for like 2 hours, like, how can I say this so that they don't be mad? And they still be mad. I'm just like, well, I tried. And then I go to other people who are more like flowery and stuff like that. And then they'd say like a example sentence. I'm like, I would have never thought of that. And I like it. But I just don't think like that. And that is awesome that I came to you and like now I can say it better, but I would have never thought to say it like that. And so, yeah.
A tribe is important. It's really important to have folks around you, whether it's asking like, hey, how do I phrase this in a different way? Or, yo, am I crazy for feeling like I'm dealing with this? Like, isolation can be one of the most dangerous parts of what we have to deal with in the workplace and just like existing.
Yeah, I choose not to think that I'm crazy. I'm like, it's happening. I might not tell other people about it because they might think I'm crazy, but I'm not crazy. So your career has been so varied. You have kind of gone into a little bit of what it is, but I feel like it's easier for you to just outline the, like from like working at Northrop to, you know, going to the, you know, curriculum designer, all the things like STEM engineers, like can you outline your path to now? It's, I feel like it's easier to for you to just do that than me to ask questions because I want it's so varied and I want to hear about how do you get to each next thing.
So, started off in engineering. While I was in engineering, I started STEM Engineers Shifting Gears, and that was an organization, a collective where engineers and college students studying engineering would come to Los Angeles and teach everything that we were working on, learning in a way that a middle schooler could understand it. All project-based and opportunities for young people to see folks that look like them that were practicing engineers, but also to really just start like building and articulating what they were learning to supplement what they were doing in the classroom. So that grew, that scaled, and as it scaled, I was living in the continent, and that's when I started going to art fairs, thinking about what it would mean to work as an artist.
Can you
And
talk about
then,
what job you were doing on the continent?
I was scaling a network of independent schools in South Africa,
And
and
how did you get that opportunity?
who that. That came from the work that I was doing through STEM Engineers. I was a board member for this network, and that there was a need that I had the expertise to apply my thinking to. And I made that position for myself, which got me to South Africa. And then I started curating art, working independently, as a curator, working with museums, galleries, but then also considering my own creative practice, specifically through conceptual work and performance art. And I was really interested in applying music and elements from direct actions, and like protests and like the aesthetic of that type of organizing, applying that to performance work. The performance that I was really excited about that I did, where I got to like experiment with all of those elements, was around Justice for Bruce's Beach, actually. So Bruce's Beach is in what's now Manhattan Beach, what's now called Manhattan Beach in Southern California. And it was a Black-owned resort and a safe place for Black folks to come to swim, to be able to stay at a hotel, and just enjoy leisure. And it was destroyed. There were KKK rallies in that part of Southern California. There was really active white supremacist organizing to destroy this beach community. The descendants of the Bruces are still alive. And Kevon Ward, the founder of Justice for Bruce's Beach, organized for the land to be returned to the Bruce family. When
I
that
remember reading about that.
I started working with Kevon when I brought performance and art to tell the story of what actually happened at Bruce's Beach at some of the early actions with the organizing of Bruce's Beach before the land was officially returned. And I worked with the Black Fist Brass Band, which is the brass band that I always perform with. And it was really interesting to be able to start to see what call and response can look like literally and figuratively in performance work and how that can show up within organizing. And that's where my performance focus has been since then.
I feel like with being a Black American, like the lack of knowledge that like white people have and some people have in the diaspora to judge us so much, but not understand how much is taken from us, because like people are always like, oh, well, I can do it, or I came here and can do it, and it's like we were doing it and it was either taken away from us. Like not a lot of people realize like a good number of people who were lynched were business owners. Like
I know.
so it's like sometimes this arrogance of like your lack of knowledge on what our history is. And you know, sometimes we don't know the history, but we have the present to draw from sometimes. So we
Yeah,
all, you
that's real.
know, it's still happening. So it's just like crazy how there's so many stories that people don't know but choose to judge Black Americans on our status.
It's we see information and the lack thereof being weaponized, which is why storytelling is so important because it gives us multiple methods that we can use to share truths with the world. And what bugs me sometimes is when it comes to talking about how important it is just for us to know stories of the Bruce's Beaches that have existed. Because just like you said, there isn't just one Bruce's Beach. This has happened and is happening all over this country since we got here, since 1619. But what our role is as storytellers is to make sure that these objective truths are told, so that the information exists and the people that are here with us and the people after us can know exactly what happened.
And it's crazy because, you know, sometimes people have this like, we are the world, we are all the same, but you notice how different our communities are, like, and namely like white people don't realize how much there is a white culture and like a separatism. Because when there was like a YouTube video some years ago when I was working in Louisiana, and you know, the history of us trying to vote, and they had the little quizzes and tests that we have to take that were impossible to take to pass. So there was a YouTube video where they were like giving those questions to, you know, Yale, Stanford, Harvard students to answer to prove a point. Like these are the smartest people, but also this test is impassable. And I remember showing one of my white coworkers at the time, and she just was like, oh, this used to happen. It's like, how do you not know that? Because we live in two different worlds. Like that is so common knowledge, but they don't know it. So I can see how they like some people think we're crazy because y'all don't know all the stuff. Like you think we're just making up stuff. Like you think we're paranoid, and it's like, no, there's all these things that happen, like sterilization of us, Native Americans, Hispanic people, like I have this random like question, because I on TikTok I was learning about, you know, how they did it to other, you know, minorities and stuff like that. And it's like, what would the percentage of minorities be in America if they didn't sterilize us for decades?
Oh, wow. Oh, wow. Have you done the math? Has someone
No,
taught
I
you
have not.
this?
It's just a question that popped up into my head like 3 weeks ago.
Wow. That would also be a really interesting like an alternate timeline.
Yeah,
Like what the
and then
supremacy
to
would
add
look
in like, how not all white people were always white, so the Germans, the Jewish, the Italians, so like there's this like let's add white people just to make our
Right.
power structure.
Right.
Like I know specifically like Jewish people became white in like 1941, 1942 because they were the founders with us of the National Urban League and the NAACP. Not a lot of
Yeah,
people
the
know
Niagara
that
Movement.
because
Yeah.
it was the colored people. Jewish people were colored people.
Exactly.
So yeah,
Exactly.
just got rid of it.
I think that would be such an interesting, I'm really interested in like in alternate histories and imagining like if something was different about our experience, like within history, how would that change how we exist now? And I think that would be really interesting to explore with the question that you asked.
Yeah, I think that's the power of Wakanda, of like what would Africa look like without colonization?
I know. Every time I visit the continent, I think about that. I was just in Rwanda for a residency, and I am in love with, I always enjoy myself when I'm there, and it's incredible to see a country that has done reconciliation the way that they did. But it really makes me wonder because for as long as they did resist colonization, it's so interesting to see how their history was impacted by that. And it just makes me wonder, like that same alternate history question, like if something had been different, what would have been different about how this place existed and how the entire continent, what that history would be like?
And like Haiti's history with them, revolting and then having to pay back France, and that's why they're poor. Like,
To this day.
yeah, to this day.
Right.
So what similarities did you see between the cult different cultures on the continent and Black American culture or even LA culture?
Oh, I appreciated Los Angeles more when I didn't live here. I used to think that I wouldn't come back to LA, that I wouldn't live here again. But specifically, Joburg made me appreciate LA because I saw so many similarities. Specifically, how different pockets of a city have like different personalities and like it's a different experience depending on where you are. That reminded me so much of home. I also, I think that there's like a certain swagger that like Black folks from LA and that live in LA have. And it's cool seeing that show up like, and it's not just sartorial, like it's not just like the fashion, but just like a certain way of taking up space that I also saw in parts of the continent. And it makes me, I mean, I'm in love with Black people, but seeing us everywhere and like all the similarities that we have as like these cousins of the diaspora, it makes me fall in love with us more and more every day.
And I had the 2 years that I lived in South Korea, and I saw similarities between, Korean people and like Black people, and like
Oh, okay.
I feel like I could walk down the street and see a Korean person, and that's like it's like that's the Korean version of my uncle, or just the Korean version of, because they have the broad noses and the full lips and stuff like that. And then I remember going to Jeju Island, and there was like this dish that I was like, this is greens,
Yes. Oh, wow. Wow.
so it's that's the power of like traveling, of seeing the differences but also the similarities.
Yeah. Exactly.
And they are
Exactly.
loud too. Like, who is louder, like a Korean man or like a ghetto Black woman? Like, I don't know. Like, 'cause they be loud. Like, I remember going walking down the street when I was teaching English, and this person was on the phone, and I'm like, you don't have to yell to the person, like the phone. Like, why are you so loud, sir? Like the point of the phone is that it's gonna reach them, so you could talk quieter.
Wow, that's so interesting. So it's a loud place too, the parts of South Korea that you were in. Interesting.
Yeah, it was, but I'm also like an introvert, so they stared at me a lot. So I was like, I'm over getting stared at. Like, you know, people
Wow.
be, try to be like, oh, just pretend you're on a runway. But I'm like, I would never be on a runway. So,
Every
that
day, every second. Oh my goodness.
And then I had like a big afro at the time. So there was like plenty of reasons to stare at me. I'm like, so.
Yeah, they had never seen anything like you before, I'm
Yeah, so.
sure.
So what do you, what would you say is the biggest breakthrough in your career, or have you had multiple breakthroughs?
Oh, what do you mean by breakthrough?
Whatever you define as a breakthrough.
I think I have multiple breakthroughs, and I'm hoping I look forward to continuing to have breakthroughs.
What are a couple that you could list?
Yeah, I would say that piece around Bruce's Beach was definitely a breakthrough for me. That was.
Yeah, the discovery of how to act, be an activist in the arts, like.
I think it was that was a breakthrough for me because I saw the different parts of these intersections of what I'm good at and what I really enjoy doing, seeing how they could manifest, but like what could be produced from that. You know what I mean? And like seeing that interest that I have for really understanding historical context, making it relevant, being able to engage and engage in this call and response with an audience to understand that they could also receive the information. And also even just like being able to like arrange music with my brass band and seeing like how we could like take up space and understanding, oh, okay, I don't need an amp. Like if I'm just working with brass, like it's loud enough. Like I was really able to like get my hands dirty and see how all of those elements could exist with each other. That was a really big breakthrough for me.
Nice. So you've had opportunity to work with multiple organizations and productions. Obviously a lot of my viewers are familiar with Insecure. So like, how did you get that opportunity, and how was it helping Black artists show their artwork in the space as a curator?
Oh yeah. I love that so much. When I have opportunities to curate work, I love when I can share artwork that excites me, share artists that excite me, but also like make sure that other folks are getting able that they are getting the opportunity to take in what I get to see that excites me as well. That's such a fulfilling feeling. That came about. I was working. Oh, actually, I had curated the artwork for a commercial, a Madewell commercial. And it was just some great, like, LA artists that I was able to put forth, recommend, and then organize the artwork that was in this commercial that Issa Rae did with Madewell. And then they reached out to me for the final season of Insecure when they wanted some artwork by talented Black artists, by artists that are in Los Angeles, that practice in LA, that are inspired by LA. And I was able to organize some work and just, get some ideas together with the art direction department to kind of tell the story of what was happening in the show and complement that with really visually engaging work.
Even though I mostly interview animation professionals, I feel like sometimes when I have other people come on my platform is important, because there are different kinds of positions that you can have in the entertainment industry that you would never think of. Can you talk more about that to give people more perspective on like that aspect of being able to be in the entertainment industry, of curating and anything else you do in the entertainment space?
Oh, yeah. So basically, anything that you're watching like on TV on the big screen when there's artwork that might be in the background of a shot or it might be like heavily featured, it has to be licensed and you have to have permission to be able to share that work. And there are usually art directors, art curators that are working in that department to source the artwork and then figure out what works to tell the story that's happening within that scene. And also how it relates to whatever the overall arc is. So as a curator, I was able to basically like source artwork, organize what the curation would be like for a few scenes for that show. I've done that for a few commercials, for other shows and series. And mm-hmm. I collect artwork too. Yeah. So I just love being around beautiful things.
Yeah.
And being able to enhance spaces with objects like that, that can help tell a story.
Nice. It's so interesting, the so many ways that people are allowed to tell their story, whether it's like the writer is telling their story through writing, the editor is telling their story, the editing, the curator is telling their story through the artwork that's in, like, everybody has their hand in telling this, the director decides, you know. So it's so cool that everybody's telling their story in their own way, but it's coming together in one piece.
Yeah. Yeah. And hopefully it's done well.
Yeah. Yes. Hopefully. So, you know, you've talked about it a little bit. People know the stereotypical ways to be an activist. How can you, you speak of the way to the ways artists and entrepreneurs can be activists?
Yeah. I think it really comes down to understanding the power and the agency that you have,
mm-hmm.
but also understanding like what's the world that you want to live in? Mm-hmm. How does it look? What's it feel like? What kind of opportunities exist? And then using the agency that you have to create that.
Yeah.
No matter what industry you're in, no matter what role that you play, I think that's, but also the organizing part of that is so important, because going back to what we were saying about isolation.
Yeah.
Organizing doesn't exist without others,
yes.
without a group. Like mm-hmm. we have to activate each other so that we can reach those goals more quickly.
Mm-hmm. What can you say about, you know, I know like after I graduated and you know, in the, there was a lot of social entrepreneurship that was kind of popular. So how can you talk about social entrepreneurship and that and the importance of that for you?
Yeah. So I didn't always know the name for mm-hmm. social entrepreneurs, but yeah. that's what I grew up around
mm-hmm.
in LA.
Yeah.
I grew up with small business owners and entrepreneurs, and there was always a priority to not only like make a profit, mm-hmm. but also to make change
yeah.
somehow, like to positively impact the industry, the community, whatever. That's the only kind of entrepreneurship that I saw.
Right.
I didn't know that was social entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. So that's just the same approach that I use with my studio practice.
Mm-hmm.
When I hire folks, when I work with other folks on projects, it's not only about making a profit or achieving the goal or finishing the art piece, but it's also about the folks that can be activated and get opportunities through the work that I get to do. That's very important to me. Everything from the band that I work with, mm-hmm. other dancers that are a part of the team, curators that I work with, institutions, like finding as many ways as possible. What the future that I believe in, that I try to organize around, is a world where Black women are fully realized and free and have yeah. all the agency that mm-hmm. we deserve.
Yeah. So you can play the electric bass. What are the forms of art you partake in that are maybe lesser known, and how do you use them in your life?
Oh wow! I didn't know you knew about the electric bass.
Wow. I did my research, you know.
I know. the other ways that I experience and partake in art.
Like, how do you use the electric bass now? Like, is it when you are stuck doing, like, is it for fun? Like,
Yeah. I don't play with a band or anything,
right.
or,
mm-hmm.
or write music or perform. That's yeah. not the kind of performance that I do.
Right.
But yeah, sometimes I just like fiddle around
mm-hmm.
and I play with my bass sometimes.
Do you still dance?
I do.
Mm-hmm.
I do. I practice. there's some choreography and a performance that I have coming up for Freeze, actually. So yeah, I still do dance. It's different. A lot of the elements that I focused on in dance, like when I was younger, I still use now. Just for like how I stretch, how I think of like my body and other bodies if I'm like arranging a tableau or something for a performance. So it's not necessarily performing like, Swan Lake or Revelations, but it's using a lot of those fundamentals.
Transferable skills.
Exactly. But writing, reading and taking in other folks' art is really inspiring for me. So taking in other people's exhibitions. I'm finishing A Little Devil in America, Hanif Abdurraqib's book that I'm really enjoying. It's about Black performance. Taking in other people's art really inspires me.
I like how I can be literally inspired by anything. I'm wondering, because you have this, analytical part of you. Like, I could be listening to like Neil deGrasse Tyson talk, and I'd be like, oh, that's something I should do in my artwork. I don't know. It'll just be something random, and I can be inspired by like I can li be listening to anything, seeing anything, and I gotta be like, oh, I should create something from that. Do you ever have those moments?
For sure. And I think that's why I'm really serious about like controlling my environment as much as I can, and also controlling like what I take in, including the art that I take in. I'm inspired from everything from like the books that I read to seeing like other folks like art installations and what they create. I really love getting to take in live music when I can and seeing like concerts and even like performances in intimate venues, because even though it may not be like performance art. Well, I mean, it still is performance art. Seeing how other people perform and like use a stage really inspires me and gives me a lot of ideas.
Yeah, last year I started going to the opera more, and how they do the stage setups, because I am a 3D modeler, so I like build sets and stuff like that in 3D. But I'm like, oh man, if I had been exposed to that when I was younger, that's probably a path I would have went into, because just how they make the stage work with each other and the turns and all this stuff, and I'm just like, that is so amazing. Like, it's
Set
so
design.
interesting.
That is cool. That is really cool. What operas did you get to see? What did you enjoy last year?
Well, the one I really liked was Omar.
My friend choreographed that.
Oh,
Tiara.
nice.
Yes. She did a fantastic job, right?
There were some others that I saw. I like, because I have the perspective of the history of like opera and the symphony and all this stuff, but it's just like 3 and 4 hour operas. Like, I understand that this was the only entertainment back then, but I'm just like, oh my God, this is so long. Like, intermission at 2 hours. Like, I remember one, I think we had to leave at like, it's just like,
It was too much.
it's so long. And I can do, I'm a millennial that can deal with long form content. Like, I produce long form content. But it's just like, my God.
And a lot of
Like,
times it's in Italian.
And so definitely gotta bring my glasses so I can read the subtitles. And then it's so interesting, like speaking of like the subtitles, like sometimes whether it's in on Netflix or like whether or in opera, like you can tell that they sometimes don't translate something, and I'm like, why? Why didn't you translate that part? And I get that sometimes, like oh, was it West Side Story, or yeah, West Side Story or something like that, where they it's this like kind of radical fight of this is our language and this is for Hispanic people, and sometimes we don't want to translate. I get it. But sometimes I'd be like, I want to know what they're saying though.
Right, like you want to understand the story.
Like, I get it for y'all people, but I'm an ally. I want to know what I took Spanish for 4 years of high school, but I still don't, I don't.
Translation, please.
But yes, so it just be like it's just so interesting. And then, or if you like play the dubbing and the subtitles, and like sometimes they say different things in the dub than the subtitles, and it's like, why did they make that choice? It's just so interesting to me, because I know I didn't watch Squid Game, but because I don't like watching people die,
I know. It's graphic for me.
but because I lived in Korea, I like I heard a lot of people talk about the dubbing and how it was like inaccurate for like what was happening, and you know sometimes the subtitles were more accurate.
I did hear about that for Squid Games.
So that's an interesting point of like the different languages and how there's like a cultural aspect of how people choose to talk and how people choose to say things. So like in Squid Game, they were like, how they translated it, you missed the point of the scene if you translate it wrong. So yeah.
Interesting. That's interesting. Yeah, language is that it's a medium too. Like that's a big part of how we take in art. So if you're translating something, I think it's extremely easy to potentially alter the medium in ways that might not be intended.
Yeah, I hope to become fluent in something, because I still have a lot of the Spanish that I learned, and then I started learning Korean, but the grammar structure, you know, that analytical part, I was like, whoo, why is it structured like this? How do you make complex sentences? So I hope to learn something fluently, because I like the aspect of like I've heard you have different personalities depending on what language you speak. Also, like if I was to get to learn Spanish fluently, like I want to be able to pick up like how people talk about the different accents, like, oh, you know, in this country is sing-songy, in this country is staccato. So I want to be able to understand it enough to be like, okay, I hear it. Because otherwise, I just hear Spanish. It's like, that I can't understand. Like, yeah, you speak Spanish, you speak Spanish. Like, I don't hear the sing-songiness yet because I don't understand it. So,
Arabic is a language that I'd really like to master. I think that is such a beautiful language, especially some of the poetry. I'm hoping that I can learn that. I want to spend more time on that this year. I really enjoy learning languages.
I do have a like a natural knack for pronunciation.
That's helpful.
Like by the time I left Korea, I was called Hanguk Saram, which means Korean person, because I could pronounce the heck out of something. I don't know a lot. I could read it, but I don't know what you're saying.
That's really dope.
How has or how did being different from the people in your environment affect you in your career? And like, how have the opportunities of being the same as people in your environment affected you?
I think having similarities to the folks like that I'm in proximity to in different parts of my career, it's definitely helpful. Like when there's like a shared language, for example, for the field, shared goal, shared understanding, that kind of familiarity is helpful. Sticking out has been helpful because you kind of have the you get this benefit of kind of being able to more easily observe. You know, like it's kind of like you're at this observation deck where you can kind of like take in everything that's happening, which is really helpful for me. And maybe again, that speaks to my analytical way of seeing things and working, but it kind of helps you see like how something exists as a system and not just like a group of people executing something, but you can kind of like see the bigger picture, which is always helpful for me. That's usually how I like to try to understand anything. Like how can I get like the 30,000 foot view and understand how this exists as an entire system?
Right, that's why I don't operate in like a lot of people on social media be like, it ain't that deep, and it's like a lot of times it is.
It is.
You don't want to see it, but you might not. You might think this little thing on social media is innocuous, but it has an effect.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Can you speak to like when you were in your STEM career, like the kind of discrimination or like being the only one? How did you experience that, and how did it affect you?
I didn't like it when folks assumed that I like worked at the front desk, or you know, those types of very racist and sexist assumptions that folks will make. But I eventually stopped taking it so personally. I think I just kind of moved through that kind of quickly and started to see some of those benefits that we talked about, like being able to see like the workplace as an entire system instead of just like a place that I showed up like from 8 to 5, which I think has actually informed the interests that I have and understanding like the intricacies and then patterns around how women and Black women are treated within the workplace, within this system. I think that definitely informed that and gave me, you know, firsthand experiences to be able to make art from.
I feel like one way I did that where I remember when I worked at a company and I shared a floor with we shared a floor with another company, and I knew someone that worked at the other company, and I remember us being in the bathroom together, but like she passed by me and like didn't like say hi. But I feel like sometimes white people don't be paying attention to Black people in general, so she's not going to acknowledge my existence enough to know that she knows me. So that's how I cannot take it personal that she didn't say hi in the bathroom, because it's like they just be like, oh, so it's like you're not even a person, you're like a blob of Black person, and so she doesn't even know that she passed by a person
Oh
that
my
she actually
goodness.
knew. So that's how I like analyze stuff sometimes. And then what else? So there was an article, like there's these like travel articles where it was like the Thomas guides or something like that, or like where you know people are complaining. But I remember one of the complaints, you know, because I feel like sometimes in America we don't realize, you know, Spain, Spanish, like those are white people, those were colonizers. And so there was like this lady from England who went to Spain, so a white person going to another white person's country, and then she was complaining about how many Spanish people were there. And so I was like, oh, y'all do this to each other. So it's like some like it is a like a racism part, but y'all be doing this to other white people. So oh, okay, so this is ingrained. Like, because sometimes the more I hear about England and like I know about America, I'm like, oh yeah, I got it honest. Like I remember I saw somewhere where English people were saying that it was rude to say excuse me. And I'm like, oh, that's why y'all don't say excuse me in the grocery store. Y'all think it's rude? Like, no, like, 'cause we think it's rude that you don't say excuse me. For y'all to just stand there on a plane or stand there on an aisle and just like wait for us to move and not say excuse me. Like, say excuse me.
Excuse me is rude. Okay, so what's the alternative?
I feel like that's why in America they descendants just be standing there like waiting for us to move. But our vantage point is that that is rude. Like, why don't you just say something? Like, just ask me to move out the way, like, in a nice way.
You know, there was a... Sorry, I'm just so like, what?
It doesn't make any
It's not logical, and white supremacy isn't logical. It's not. There's this line in A Little Devil in America that says, to understand whiteness is an endless task. I think that's what he wrote. But we cannot apply logic, as much as we might try to things that are illogical, make no sense, are not humane or intuitive, like white supremacy, like systems like that. As much as we try to understand it will never make sense to us because it's not based in logic.
Yeah, that's why you can't really argue with racists
Nope.
because, like, you're never going to logic their way into anything because it's not logical.
Exactly. And I love the way you said that you're not the what was it? Blackness 101 person? Is that what you say?
Yes. I'm not your intro to blackness person. I'm like I'm 201, 301, maybe 401.
Graduate level course for you.
Right.
I've really started to understand, and it's also just better for my health, my productivity, not productivity as a function of capitalism. Productivity as me doing what I need to get done while I am here on this earth in this lifetime. My energy and time are not well spent in trying to argue with white supremacy, understand white supremacy. I've moved to, How can I cultivate joy? How can I cultivate
Yeah.
the models of an existence that fuels us? And as a result, that being resistant, so that eventually all the other bullshit is obsolete and doesn't serve a purpose.
Because even when you were talking earlier about being careful what you bring in, Walter Scott was the first video I did not watch of a black man getting killed. And I haven't watched the video since then.
Yeah.
Even there was like a couple years ago, there was like this older white gentleman on some steps. And like he was trying to hand the police helmet back to the police officer. And they like knocked him in the head. And I accidentally watched that because, you know, some videos autoplay on like Twitter or whatever. Yeah. And I was like, I didn't want to watch that.
Yeah.
And that's not even a black man. And then all 4 years of Trump's presidency, I never watched him talk, speak, like, because I'm a very active listener and I know he speaks in sound bites. So I can't, like, my brain.
You couldn't even process it.
like if you listen to people in passing, like you can listen to him speak and it's not a problem, but I actively, like, I pay attention to what people are saying.
Yeah.
And so I was like, for my mental, I cannot listen to his speeches. Like, so I never listened to any Trump, like the State of the Union, none of that. I refused.
I love it. I love it.
Because he ain't going to be making sense. So why?
Again, it's trying to apply logic to something that's not based in logic.
Right.
45 was, there was no logic whatsoever. And we survived that.
Yes. We survived.
And you survived through refusal, which I love.
Right. I'll be damned. So what have you decided is your purpose in regard to blackness and black professionals in the entertainment industry?
Oh, wow. What is my purpose? I think it relates to the reality that I want to build and like making decisions every day related to making that reality closer and closer. My purpose is to cultivate, create, organize the visual vocabulary of a world in which Black women are free. And a part of why that's like so central to my praxis is the Combahee River Collective statement. And specifically where they wrote that if Black women are free, everyone else will be free, because inevitably the systems that oppress all of us would have to be dismantled in order for us to show up and live freely.
Right.
So everybody benefits from our freedom.
And it's crazy how even white people don't see that they benefit from our fight.
Absolutely.
Because they're 70, like they're 70% of the population. So we get, you know, I'm not sure how familiar you are, but you know, the Ronald Reagan's welfare queen archetype is actually based off of white women, but it's attributed to black people.
Yeah.
But if 70% of a population is in, like, they're the most on welfare, they're the most like anything. So us fighting for our thing helps them too.
Yeah.
Not just other minorities who may or may not be like, oh, why? Like, you know, certain other minorities are like, oh, I don't find that serious, or we don't do that. And it's like, well, us, how about you just sit on the couch? Because what we're doing is going to help you eventually too.
Exactly. Get out of the way. It's a word. Yeah. Everybody benefits from our freedom.
Yeah.
So I am actively building a world in which our freedom is a reality. That is success to me.
Did you ever see that post, was it last year or the year before, where they were asking women, like, if men were not here, what's something that you would do? Like,
my friend and I were just talking about this.
Yeah.
Right? And wasn't, like, the most frequent response, I would ride the metro at night?
Yeah, or I would just walk the street. I would just take a walk.
That's ridiculous.
And it's the most simple things.
Exactly.
And then to possibly have people of other demographic, like men, be like, that's dumb or something. Like, you don't realize, like, it's kind of crazy. I've had a couple of disagreements with, like, black men on the fact that they have male privilege, because what they hear is white male privilege when I say you have male privilege. And it's like, just because you're a black man doesn't mean you don't have male privilege.
Right.
You don't have
Right.
white male privilege, which is what you're taking in, but you have male privilege.
Why do you think they were so quick to associate male privilege with white male privilege?
Because, like, we are the downtrodden, so there's no benefit that I have in my life. But if you lived as a black woman, you would know that you still have the agency to, I mean, you might not have the agency, depending on your environment, to walk down the street without the police interacting with you, but you wouldn't have a man also be the reason you are scared to walk down the street as well.
Exactly. And reproductive rights.
Or like even yes, on Twitter there was like a bunch of women talking about what how they exist of like putting the keys in your hand and like a bunch of men not responding like I remember Kev on stage, like his wife would call him on the way to like her car and all that stuff, which is like something we learn, but he was like, oh, I thought she just wanted to talk to me. I didn't know it was like a form of protection. Like there's men out there who don't know, like, I'm calling you because I want, if I get kidnapped, I need you to know that I got kidnapped in real time. Like, or like if something's happening, I need you to know to call 911. Like, it's not just 'cause I like calling you.
Wow. What? He thought that she just wanted to talk. That's, oh my goodness.
So that's that male, like the male privilege of like you would never just like call somebody just so you could walk to your vehicle, like.
And also the privilege of not having to create systems to protect yourself.
Yeah. The black girl follow train.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Oh,
Which is an
wow.
awesome activation.
As much as it upsets me that we have had to create these technologies, these systems to protect ourselves, to see each other, our creativity and our
Yes.
genius is hella inspiring. Can't
Yeah.
nobody do this like us.
And something, I remember having a conversation with somebody where, so much of like being a Black American is like doing a lot with less. And so as we gain more privilege, how do we keep our Black magic? Because we're going to have more. And so will that go away?
I don't think so.
Like
I don't
how
think
will
our
it,
creativity.
or like if and if it doesn't, how will it transform? That would be interesting. How does our black girl magic, our black boy joy, our everything transform when we have more?
I think that our creativity, our magic, that the ingenuity that we have, I think that it is being amplified, and it will be as we continue to have more resources, because I don't think that goes away. Like there's so many practices and like genius technologies that we've inherited from ancestors that had way less than we do now. And we still use some of those, you know?
And because even these interviews I do come from a place of lack because I had a computer that I could not run Adobe After Effects on. And so I have all these ideas of like produced videos, and I was like, I can't. Like, I have to do so much to just create these little videos. So I'm like, what content can I have where it's not that much labor on my computer? And it was like interviews. I could chop the beginning, chop the end. There you go, people. And now it's like my most popular thing on my channel.
What do they say? Necessity is the mother of creativity.
Yes. So what do you hope artists what do you hope black artists are doing in this current landscape with the access to technology, powerful handheld devices, all like whether it's in your space or in general?
What do I hope that artists are doing with?
Yeah, because I always bring up Issa Rae of like her doing Awkward Black Girl, but sometimes even though we're young, like people our age and younger are still in this like archaic thought of like I have to pitch or I have to do this, and it's like just do what Issa Rae did and create now. So what do you hope people are doing with what they have now and not waiting for someone else?
Well, definitely creating an MVP. And I think that with any medium, if you're an artist, I think artists are entrepreneurs. As an artist, you have to be an entrepreneur, and entrepreneurs are creative. Like you, there's creativity that you have to tap into. So I would say for folks in any kind of industry, however you identify, whatever you're organizing your life around, don't be afraid to create something, your minimum viable product. Make something, and it goes back to the scientific method. Like test it, you know? You can't, I see so many people get caught up in the, oh, I have to make a really good looking deck, or let me do like all of these customer interviews first, or, you know, I want to keep like, you know, my cards close to my chest and not share anything or make anything yet. No, you have to make something, put something out, because it's also not your responsibility to assume how an audience is going to receive it. At a certain point, it just becomes selfish as a creative if you have made something and you refuse to let it see the light of day, because you don't know whose inspiration you're blocking, or what impact you might make that you can't even imagine.
The community aspect of it.
Exactly. Just because you caught up wanting to make the perfect deck for whatever your idea is, like you got to put something out, put an MVP out, test it, and then you go back and perfect. But don't let perfection get in the way of
As a
dreams.
recovering perfectionist, I
Oh,
had to learn how to do that. 2016, I created a hashtag called hashtag action execution so I could
say
learn
it one
how
more
to
time.
do. I had in 2016, I created a hashtag for the year called hashtag action and execution because I was like, I would like research, read articles, da, 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 and not do anything. And so I was like, I need to learn how to do because that's the perfectionism. I'm trying to do it perfect the first time.
Which is
And so,
impossible.
yes. So I'm 70% delivered from perfectionism.
Congratulations.
So
Congratulations.
I know how to do now. Like even like, you know, in my 20s, it was like, if I would have came out with some type of flyer and it had the wrong date on it, I'd be like, oh my God. But like, I remember when I was like president of the Urban League Young Professionals in New Orleans and I had the wrong day, I was like, I'll just fix it. Or like, I don't got time to like worry about that. And so
Exactly.
I'm happy to see my own growth of like not worrying about things. And it's just a mistake.
That is so dope. Wow, I love that. I also love how honest you are with sharing your own journey, because
Which is a journey in itself because when I was in, like, I could not tell him there's so much of like certain parts of black culture, like black American culture, is like telling embarrassing things and laughing at yourself. And I could not do that in college. There was a story I had in college that I didn't tell to like 7 years after college because I was too embarrassed that it happened. So that has been a journey in it itself of like saying my imperfections and saying embarrassing stories and all that
Radical
type stuff.
honesty. Yeah, I'm here for it. I'm here for it.
So and so my last question, if someone was producing a documentary about you, what
Oh.
things would you want them to highlight about your life outside of your career, like outside of your work in art, entertainment, activism, social entrepreneurship? What things would you want them to highlight?
Ooh. Most of the documentaries that I really like, I identify like these factors that may not be super obvious to the subject about what has influenced what they do, how they do it. So I would love for a documentarian if they highlighted my family, and how that's impacted me. Like the story of my grandparents, how they came to Los Angeles, my mom, my aunts and uncles, all of these things that were a very big part of shaping who I am. And still do, still absolutely do. I would love to see that highlighted. I think that, but I think that would be essential for telling like a whole story of me, because that's a big part of my influence.
So where can people follow you on the social medias and whatnot?
Yeah, but my name is my Instagram handle, Autumn Brion. That's where you can keep up with me and all the fun stuff that I get to do and work on.
And I would like to thank you for allowing me to highlight you. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. This was so much fun. fun. I so enjoyed our conversation. I just feel like we're like having tea or something. I hope I get to see you in person soon.
Yes, hopefully. I hope like I can come to some activation or something.
Yes, I would love that. I would absolutely love that. And then maybe we'll be matching.
Yes, again. Yellow gang. Gang gang. We bring the sunshine.
That's right. That's right.
All right, to everyone out there, I want you to like So I Know It's Real, comment and tell me how you feel, subscribe to Citadel, and sign up for post notifications to show your zeal, and I'll see you in the next video. Peace.